them gasped and forgot where they were. An enchantment took over, and people stood in silence. White moths appeared from the grass. They spun past, higher all the time, until they disappeared into the sky. Vincent was grateful this was the way he was able to leave behind everything he had known before. He collapsed, and when he could not be revived, a doctor who was a friend of Madame Durant's signed the death certificate at 11:58. It was still All Hallows' Eve. The temperature had dropped. Raindrops fell and splattered on the sidewalks. A private ambulance was sent for. Reporters had been called so they might witness his death. The leaves were curling in the cold, and no one seemed to have the ability to speak. All was still, except for the siren as the ambulance pulled away. And then, at a little after midnight, the sound of the falling rain turned hard as it became ice, striking against the sidewalks and the brown leaves of the chestnut trees. Madame Durant was the one who made the funeral arrangements, acting swiftly so no questions would be asked. She had placed a very old disappearing spell over Vincent as he'd lain prone. L'homme invisible. From that moment on, no one would ever figure out the private details of his life. All the same, the newspapers were filled with reports of his strange death. There were insinuations, with some convinced he had taken his own life, and others vowing there had been foul play. A small vigil had begun outside the hotel where he had stayed in the Marais, with flowers deposited in a fragrant, muddy pile, and white candles lit so that wax flowed into the gutter. The radio stations played I Walk at Night, and people who didn't know Vincent's name found themselves singing the lyrics as they walked home from work. The burial was at Père Lachaise, the cemetery opened by Napoleon in 1804. Jet and Franny's plane was hours late, delayed by a storm in New York. William had traveled with them, wearing a black suit, carrying only a leather backpack. He spoke very little, and seemed so distant the sisters wondered if because he had the sight, he had known this was to be his fate all along, to be traveling to France for a funeral. They took a taxi to the main entrance of the cemetery on Boulevard de Ménilmontant, with William telling the driver that if he ignored stoplights, they would pay him double his fare. "We must be there," William said. "We will," Jed assured him. Franny simply stared out the window. She had barely spoken since the news had come. She was meant to protect him, and she had failed. Her plans had gone awry, and now he was lost to them. Once at the cemetery, they had soon become disoriented among the angels and monuments until a young man sent by Agnes Durant to search for the missing Americans guided them to the freshly turned grave. "It can be very confusing here," the young man said as he led them down the gravel paths. "Yes," the sisters agreed. They had never been more confused in their lives. Why did their thoughts become blurry when they tried to think of their brother? "This place is very old, and there are so many dead people," explained their guide, who dressed much as Vincent might have, in a dark coat, with black Levi's from America and suede boots. For Vincent to have had a heart attack at such a young age was unthinkable, but such was the doctor's report. The sisters could not conceive of a world in which he was gone. They had decided to wear white dresses that Jet had found in the resale shop next to the Chelsea Hotel. They refused to wear black on this day. It was only now that Franny realized what Jet had chosen. "These are wedding dresses," she whispered, annoyed. "You said white. These were all they had on the rack," Jet said apologetically. Though it was November and chilly, they slipped off their shoes out of respect. The other guests were friends of Agnes's and, as it turned out, of their mother's. The brevity of the service was fitting. Vincent did not like an excess of emotion, unless it was real love, and then nothing was too much. Agnes hugged the sisters, then kissed William twice. "It's a pleasure to meet you," she said to him warmly. "I have heard so much about you, and now here you are." The mourners went to a restaurant nearby for a light dinner. The place was small, lit by candles even in the daylight hours, decorated with trompe-l'oeil wallpaper and velvet couches to sit on while they dined.
"Susanna and I came here often when we were young," Agnès Durand said, "and we often went to the cafés in the Tuileries, where I first met Vincent.
Susanna and I looked so alike, people thought we were sisters."
"Well, we look nothing alike, and we are sisters," Jet said, taking Franny's hand in hers. She felt as though they had somehow lost Vincent to this stranger who gazed at them with curious dark eyes.
"I only meant I feel that I'm family to you," Madame Durant said, trying to soothe Jet's ruffled feathers.
"Thank you," Franny said. "Please understand we have lost an actual member of our family."
"Of course, I would never intrude. I have your best interests at heart."
Franny found that difficult to believe, but she was distracted by the presentation of their supper, which included hors d'oeuvres of oysters and cheeses. The restaurant owner had a little dachshund that lounged on one of the velvet couches. It was only then Franny realized that William wasn't among them. She imagined he was still at the cemetery, unwilling to leave his beloved. How horrid they had forgotten him in his hour of need.
"I'll be right back," Franny told Jet as she dashed out, hoping she would find her way back to the burial site.
The hour was late and night was falling. She felt panic rising in the back of her throat as she darted along the streets in the evening light, finally finding the pedestrian gate of the cemetery at Port du Respeau and hurrying inside. There was ice on the paths, and her breath came out in cold puffs, and the white dress was much too sheer and flimsy for the chill of the day. Gravediggers were flinging clods of earth over the open grave. Franny stopped. Her heart felt too heavy for her chest. There was the shadow of a tall man.
"William!" she called.
But if it was he did not respond. Franny held one hand over her eyes as the sun went down, and the orange light made it difficult to see. The leaves on the trees were rustling, and swirls of earth rose up from the ground.
"Is it you?" Franny cried. She couldn't tell if she saw one man's shadow or two.
And then she knew. She felt her brother near, just as she had when they played hide-and-seek in the basement and their mother could never find them. She followed the path, but the orange light was blinding, and she bumped into a woman bringing flowers to a grave and had to apologize. She didn't realize that she was crying until she spoke to the other mourner. Her apology was accepted with a shrug, and then she was alone. She stopped and watched as the light grew darker and the shadows longer. And then, when it was clear she would not find her way, she returned the way she'd come. She went back to the restaurant, arriving as Halen was getting out of a taxi. He'd flown from Frankfurt, where he'd been stationed, and now he embraced Franny on the sidewalk. He kissed her and could not stop. It was Paris, so no one looked at them twice.
"I should have been here sooner," he said.
"You're here now?"
Franny seemed more in shock than grief-stricken. She barely spoke that evening. As the dinner was ending with aperitifs and small cakes, Franny went to Agnès and asked if she could call on her the next day.
"I want to thank you and perhaps get to know you better, as my mother did. I was rude before, and I apologize."
"I'm so sorry," Agnès demurred. "I'm closing up my apartment. I really won't have time. I'm going out to my country house."
"So that's it? Vincent is gone and we don't speak about it?"
Agnès shrugged.
"How can we understand life?"
"It's impossible.
To the world, Vincent is dead and buried."
"Let's leave it that way, my dear." "And we don't speak of William either? I'm not even sure where he is. What do I do when his father calls me and asks where he is?"
"William is where he wants to be. How many among us can lay claim to that?"
Franny rushed back to the hotel in Jet's room.
"William lied to us," she told her sister. "He let us go through that charade of a funeral. All the while, that Madame Durant had placed a disappearing spell on Vincent so we wouldn't know the truth. He's alive, Jetty."
"If William lied, he did it for Vincent."
You knew we were going to lose him. I suppose this was the best way.
To make us think he had died?
Even for a few hours, it had been horrible.
He has died.
For us. And we must keep it that way if we want him to be safe. At the hotel, Jet was happy to leave Franny and Halen to each other. She preferred to be alone to grieve. The loss of her brother affected her deeply. She went to her room, and when she took off the hat she'd been wearing all day, she found that her hair had gone white all at once. It had happened at the funeral. Her best feature, her long black hair, gone. She gazed into a mirror above the bureau and spied the woman she had seen in their aunt's black mirror. She wondered what Levi would have thought if he was with her. Perhaps he would have lain down beside her and told her she was still beautiful, even if it wasn't true. He would have read to her from a book of poems, then perhaps planned where they would go for a drink, someplace somber but warm, where they could sit close together. But now, without him, she had stepped into her future, and like it or not, this was who she'd turned out to be. He was a boy, and she was now a woman who had lost nearly everyone she'd ever loved. She thought of what she'd told April once. This was what happened when you were alive. She called the desk and asked for some coffee, since she already knew she wouldn't be able to sleep. Paris was too noisy, the room was too cold. The injury of losing Vincent too fresh. She did not mind being alone. She sat beside the window and wrote a postcard to Raphael. She always wrote him postcards, even when they were both in New York City, and then when they got together they would read the postcards in bed. She wished he were here with her now. Just as a friend, of course. The friend she wanted to be with more than any other. It had begun to rain. A thin green drizzle that made the sidewalks shine. "Paris is sad," she wrote, "but beautiful enough to make you not care about sadness." Franny fell asleep beside Halen, exhausted. When she woke, he was sitting on the edge of the bed watching the rain falling. They were supposed to stay away from each other, but their pact didn't need to apply yesterday, nor today. The sky outside was thick with rain clouds. Paris was so gray in November. Wood doves were gathering on the small balcony. Franny held out her hands to them and they pecked at the glass. She wished they never had to leave this room, but they did. Halen had told her he was being transferred to the field. He would be leaving in less than 8 hours for Vietnam. They spent those 8 hours in bed. Telling each other they didn't love each other. They did so for luck and to do their best to ensure they would one day see each other again. The sisters packed up and called a taxi. They went to the Tuileries and walked down the gravel paths. The leaves were turning brown. They had their suitcases with them, so they stopped at the first cafe they came to in the park. They ordered white wine, but they didn't drink much. They were thinking about their mother when she was young. And the rules she'd made up to protect them. They had their own rules now. Franny cast a circle in the gravel beside their table. Then she took one of Louis's feathers that she had in her pocket. She let the feather fall. Outside the circle, and their brother was gone. But it landed inside, right in the center. Jet let out a sob. Franny reached for her hand. It was good news. He was somewhere close by, but when the feather blew away, they knew the other side of the truth. He was lost to them now. When the sisters returned to New York, Franny took to spending the night in Vincent's room. From here, she could hear the echo of children in the schoolyard in the mornings. She let the crow remain inside. He was aging, and he liked to perch on the desk near the heater, where he dozed in fits and starts. The dog followed Franny around, but she was a poor substitute for Vincent, and he began sleeping at the front door, waiting for his master to reappear. Both sisters slept uneasily upon their return, disturbed by sounds of the city, the rumble of buses, the shrill sirens, the ever-present traffic on 7th Avenue. When Franny opened the window, she found that New York City had only one scent now, and it never changed. It was the sharp tang of regret. She longed for something darker and greener, for a silence that might allow her to find some peace. One night she dreamed that Isabel was sitting on the window seat of the old house in Massachusetts.
"You know the answer," Isabel said. "Fate is what you make it."
When Franny awoke, she realized she was homesick. She was at the kitchen table when Jet came downstairs. To Franny, Jet seemed even more beautiful with her white hair, for her beauty was rooted inside of her now. "I'm ready to go," Franny told her sister. In fact, she had already packed up her room. Jet looked at her surprised. "Go where?"
"The place we feel most at home."
"All right. We'll shut down the store. I'll call the attorney. He can manage selling this place. It was temporary for us. Now the rightful tenant can have it." Jet understood her sister's wish to leave New York. 44 Greenwich Avenue was already becoming the past as they sat there. It was disappearing in front of their eyes. It had been a home for the three of them, but they were three no longer. She thought of Vincent playing I Walk at Night for the first time, of April visiting with Regina and eating chocolate cake in the kitchen, of the plumber who did work for them in exchange for a love spell, and of the night when Vincent came home and told them he was in love. As for Franny, what she remembered most was standing outside on the sidewalk, looking up at the windows, knowing that lilacs grew here, and that she would buy this house, and that for a while they would live here and try to be happy. And in a way, they were. During the course of 2 years, Franny collected 120 letters from Halen, all wrapped in string, kept in the bureau in the dining room. The house on Greenwich Avenue had been sold and divided into offices. A literary agent had taken the rooms on the third floor, and her desk was now in the space where Vincent's room had been. She was a lovely woman with a beautiful smile, who filled up her bookshelves along the wall where his bed had been. For a while, the shop was a mystery bookstore, and occasionally the owners found red thread and wishbones in unexpected places. The ramshackle greenhouse Vincent had built was pulled down and carted away, but some of the seeds scattered through the neighborhood so that foxgloves and sunflowers grew in the alleys for several seasons. They took the tilted kitchen table that had been in their family house on 89th Street, and they took Edgar, the stuffed heron, whom they kept in the parlor of Aunt Isabel's house, and decorated every Yule with silver trimmings and gold tinsel. The sisters settled into the Owens house on Magnolia Street. It felt like home in no time. Franny took Aunt Isabel's room, where Louis, now so aged his feathers had begun to turn white, nested on the bureau. Jet was happy to have the guest room where April Owens had stayed when they refused to share a room with her. The attic, where they'd spent their first summer, was a place for young girls, not for grown women who needed more comfortable beds, so they used it for storage. Harry still slept by the door, waiting for his master, while Wren kept to the garden, where she chased off rabbits and mice. They had an entire winter in which to restore everything that had been ignored for so long. Charlie came to clear out the gutters, cut back the vines on the porch, and deliver a cord of wood for the fireplace. He said it was grand to see people in the house again. "I miss your aunt," he told the sisters. "She was one of a kind, for certain." On days when the sky was spitting out snow, Jet took possession of the window seat to read from one of her beloved novels. Magic came back to her slowly, like a long-forgotten dream that hovered nearby. Now that she lived in town, she visited the cemetery every Sunday. She walked, no matter the weather. Some children called her the Daffodil Lady, because she always carried a bunch of the blooms. Sometimes the Reverend gave her a ride home, especially if it was raining hard. He was there every Sunday as well. In nice weather, he brought two lawn chairs, and when the sky was overcast, he brought a large black umbrella. They didn't talk very much, although the Reverend noticed that Jet still wore the moonstone ring Levi had given her. And Jet saw that the Reverend kept one of Levi's swimming medals pinned to his jacket. When they talked about the weather, as people in Massachusetts often do. "Cold," he would say. And she would agree with a word or two, and then one day she brought mittens she had knitted for him out of soft gray wool. The next time he brought the scarf she had made for Levi, which made her cry. She ducked her head so that the Reverend wouldn't see, although he could tell all the same. He carried a handkerchief and gave it to her and gently said, "This comes in handy." In the spring, he handed her a new business card he'd had printed. He had gone back to work and was now a justice of the peace. He had already married 6 couples. He told her that one couple had phoned him in the middle of the night, desperate to marry, so he had performed the service in his living room dressed in his pajamas. One day he said, "Maybe you should move on with your life." Jet was grateful for his kind thought. Years had passed. She still met Raphael in the city several times a year. For a while, he saw another woman, and thinking he wanted a family, he was married briefly. But in the end, he divorced. His wife didn't know him the way Jet did. They could talk with each other in a way they couldn't with anyone else, and so they began to see each other again. Raphael was the principal of a school in Queens, and several times a year they went to the Oak Bar at the Plaza Hotel for old time's sake. They often spent the night together in his apartment. Once he had suggested marriage, but Jet told him she thought it was a bad idea. It would get in the way of things. The truth was she still worried about the curse, even though she hoped such things could be broken. She didn't want to chance its ill effects. She thought it best if Raphael was only a dear friend. He agreed to this even though he was in love with her. He didn't tell her so, but she knew. Just as he knew what her intentions had been that night at the Plaza Hotel. They didn't need the sight to know how one another felt. "I'm fine," she told the Reverend on the day he told her to get on with her life. And she was. She did not discuss her grief with anyone, but she could share it with the Reverend. But then one Sunday, Jet failed to appear. The Reverend scanned the field, waiting for her to arrive, but she didn't. It felt strange without her there, not right somehow. So he drove over to Magnolia Street and parked outside the house. He sat there in his idling car until Franny came outside. The Reverend rolled down his window. He'd never spoken to Franny. He'd only see her walking through town in her black coat, her red hair piled on top of her head. People were afraid of her. They said she was not one to cross. Up close, she was taller than he had expected, and prettier. "She has pneumonia," Franny said. "I wouldn't let her go to the cemetery." It was a damp, drizzly day, and the Reverend more than understood. He nodded. "Tell her I'll see her next week." "Tell her yourself," Franny said. They looked at each other. Then the Reverend got out of his car and followed Franny into the house. He noticed that the wisteria was blooming, always the first in town to do so. This was the house that had been built with money his ancestor had given to a woman he had loved, then had called a witch. He wondered how often that had happened, both then and now. He carried the burden of his family with him and was weighed down by the wrong they'd done in the world. The Reverend had arthritis, so Franny slowed her usually quick gait. Jet was in the parlor, a blanket around her, drinking tea, reading Sense and Sensibility, which she could happily reread time and again. When she saw the Reverend, she was so startled she dropped her book, then quickly bent to retrieve it. She felt fluttery having him in the house, as if something momentous was happening, even though everything was so very quiet. "Sorry to hear you're not well," the Reverend said. "I'll be better by next week," Jet said. "I expect you will be," the Reverend said. "The weather will be better then, too, so they say." "Yes, I've heard that, too." No rain. Good, the Reverend said. He looked around. The woodwork is nice.
Yes, it is. It doesn't need much care, but I use a little olive oil on the dust cloth every once in a while.
Olive oil, he murmured. I never would have thought of that.
It's natural. No chemicals, Jet said.
I'll try that sometime, the Reverend said, even though he hadn't dusted the woodwork in his house for years.
The next week was sunny and dry, and on Sunday Jet went back to the cemetery. She wore boots and a sweater and woolen slacks. She still had a cough, but she'd had a cup of licorice tea before she left the house that would quiet it. She didn't want Levi's father to worry. When he did, there was a line across his forehead, the same line that Levi had across his forehead when he was concerned. The Reverend looked relieved when he saw Jet walking across the grass, and he waved. Jet thought perhaps she was fine, considering everything that had happened, and that by coming here each week she had made her own fate. She was a woman a person could depend on, in fair weather and foul. The sky was very blue, and the Reverend said this was because in Massachusetts, if you waited a few minutes, the weather was sure to change, and she agreed and said that in her experience that had always been true. On the harshest days of the year, Franny could be seen stalking through town on her way to Leech Lake without use of a hat or gloves. She had discovered that the woods circling the lake fell into the pattern of migration of scarlet tanagers. On the grayest days, the nearby bushes were bright red, as if each branch had a heart, and each heart could fly away in an instant. All Franny had to do was hold out her hands, and they came to her. She laughed and fed them seed. She knew they would be far away in no time, to warmer climates near the Mexican border. She herself no longer had the urge to fly away. She was happy to be where she was. That first winter, Franny walked to the library on the day the board convened. There was muffled shock when she arrived. The president of the board shook Franny's hand and offered her a cup of tea, which she declined. The members of the board didn't know whether to be flattered or terrified when Franny then stood to announce her intention to serve on the board, and all raised their hands to vote yea to include her. When Franny's first request was permission to have the rare book room dedicated to Maria Owens, assuring them that in return she would make a donation to the library, the members of the board were relieved. As that room had been Maria's jail cell, it was only right that she be remembered here. Pages from Maria's journal were framed and hung on the wall. Teenage girls, especially those who considered themselves outcasts and were interested in the town's history of witchcraft, often came to study the pages. They didn't understand why a brave, independent woman had been so brutally treated. Many of them began to wonder why they themselves often feigned opinions rather than speak their minds, no matter how clever they were, for fear they'd be thought of as difficult. Some of these girls came to stand at the fence so they could gaze into the garden. At dusk, everything looked blue, even the leaves on the lilacs. When spring came around and the lilacs bloomed, Franny began to leave blank journals on the bureau in Maria's room in the library, and every week they were taken home by girls who questioned their worth in the modern world. Walking past Leech Lake, Franny often spied one or two perched on a rock, writing furiously in their journals, clearly convinced that words could save them. Summer came, and with it the sparrow. This time, however, the bird that could bring a year's worth of bad luck was met by Lewis, who had perched on the dining room mantel. The poor, hapless sparrow swiftly flew out the window. "Good work," Franny said to the crow. Despite her flattery, he eyed her with suspicion. They were wary allies who both happened to adore the same person.
"Even if you don't like me, come have a cookie," Franny said,
for she knew the crow liked anise biscuits, and she just made some. She had been thinking of various ways for them to earn money. The house had its own trust to support its upkeep, but without the shop, the sisters had no regular employment.
Franny had made the rash donation to the library, and there was no shop to help them pay the bills. She thought of baking for profit, but it was so time-consuming. Her biscuits were chewy and probably wouldn't sell, and the ingredients of the tipsy cake were so costly. The bars of chocolate, the extra-fine aged rum, they'd never bring in a cent. Franny put in an application at the dress shop, but when the owner saw her name, she quickly said the job was filled, a blister already forming on her tongue as she spoke. So much the better, really, as Franny had no interest in clothes and wore the same black dress and red boots, which were mud-caked and in need of new heels. Her rejections continued at the pharmacy and the grocery store. The baker looked positively terrified when she walked in the door. His customers didn't favor anise, he said. And as for rum in a cake, well, that would never do. The shopkeepers did their best to be pleasant enough, though they all had a frantic look in their eyes when she came into their shops, the bells over their doors refusing to ring. She had that effect. She stopped things with her chilly manner. "It's really not a job for you," the bookshop owner had said when she went to ask for a job. "Perhaps your sister?" Of course people would prefer Jet. She was kinder and much more well-mannered. And Franny did look savage with her wild red hair and her threadbare black coat. She had lost weight and was gawky, as she'd been when she was a girl. Even when she dabbed powder on her freckled skin, she looked sulky and unkempt. And those boots, well, they gave her away. Red as heartbreak. An Owens woman, through and through. In the summertime, Franny missed Vincent more than ever. She went to Leech Lake, where she stood on the grassy bank to strip off her clothes. Then she waded in to float in the cold, green water. No leeches came near. There were only dragonflies skimming over the surface of the lake. "You know who we are," Vincent had said to her that first summer. And she had, but she hadn't wanted to admit it. She didn't want to be condemned because of her family history or be pigeonholed as an Owens. She longed to be free, a bird in the sky over Central Park, unconnected to the fragile world. None of that seemed to matter anymore. In the shallows of the lake, she closed her eyes and floated through the cattails. The water turned jewel blue once she reached the depths, which were said to be bottomless. There were rumors of ancient fish living in the deepest parts of the lake, creatures that hadn't been seen for 100 years, but all Franny saw were frogs in the shallows, and occasionally an eel slipping through the reeds. One day she noticed some girls watching her. She swam to shore, where she ducked behind some thorn bushes and swiftly dressed. "You're a good floater," one of the girls said to her. "Thanks," Franny said, wringing out her hair. The water that fell onto the ground was red. The other girls all took off, but one stayed behind, the one who had spoken. "Is that blood?" the girl now asked. "Not at all. It's hair dye." It was neither. It was simply the way her hair reacted to water. But Franny wasn't about to explain that to a 10-year-old. She'd never cared for children. She hadn't much liked herself when she was one. The other girls had scattered to climb up the rocks. "That's dangerous," Franny called. No one paid attention to her, except for the one girl who was still staring at her. "Not that it's any of my business," Franny said brusquely. "Is it true that you can't be drowned?" the girl asked. "Anyone can be drowned, given the right circumstances." The girl was plain but had a bright spark of intelligence in her eyes. "Why do you ask?" "I thought you were a witch." "Really?" By now, Franny was slipping on her boots. She wore them in every season, even in summer. They were so much better than shoes for gardening.
"Who told you that?"
"Everyone says so."
"Well, everyone doesn't know everything," Franny responded.
She sounded crotchety, even to herself. The girl was carrying a backpack. A blue journal peeking out caught Franny's attention.
It was one of the notebooks she'd left in the library.
"Are you writing?"
she asked.
"Trying to,"
the girl said.
"Don't try. Do."
She realized she sounded exactly like Aunt Isabel when she was irritated. She hadn't meant to be a wet blanket and had no wish to discourage this clever little girl, so she changed her tone.
"But trying is a start. What is your story?" "My life."
"Ah.
If you write it all down, it doesn't hurt as much."
"Yes, I can imagine," Franny said. The girl scampered onto the rocks to join her friends. She waved, and Franny waved back. As she walked home, Franny thought that the girl at the lake had been perfectly right. It helped to write things down. It ordered your thoughts, and if you were lucky, revealed feelings you didn't know you had. That same afternoon, Franny wrote a long letter to Halen. She had never told anyone what her aunt had whispered with her last breath. But now she wrote it down, and when she did, she realized it was what she believed, despite the curse.
"Love more," her aunt had said. "Not less."
Jet remembered how much she had enjoyed puttering in the garden when she began working there again. Everything flourished under her touch. She planted spring onions and mint and cabbages and rue and basil and Spanish garlic. She put in lemon thyme, lemon balm, lemon verbena, foxgloves, and zinnias, making sure to plant rosemary and lavender by the back door, where it had grown when Isabel was there. The Reverend gave her some of his bulbs, so she could grow clutches of daffodils and bring her own flowers to the cemetery on her visits. Some were white with orange centers, some were golden, some were butter yellow. When they bloomed, she cried, because she knew another year had gone by and it was all happening so fast. The more dangerous plants were ordered from the Owens farm in Rockport, Maine, and these Jet grew in the greenhouse, still locked with an old iron key. No reason to take a chance that teenagers who could easily mistake wolfsbane for marijuana might manage to get inside and binge on poison. There, behind glass, she kept belladonna, hemlock, nightshade, which could induce visions and was said to be in the ointment that allowed witches to fly, henbane, known as black nightshade, used by men to attract women and by women to bring rain, mandrake, an herb said to scream when plucked from the ground by its roots, thorn apple, used for healing and for breaking hexes, but only in tiny amounts, otherwise death might result. One day she saw the old rabbit, Maggie, near the greenhouse, hiding from the cat. Franny had come out, and they stood there together. It was definitely Maggie, with her black whiskers and sad eyes.
"Let's set her free," Jet said.
Franny went over and grabbed the rabbit before it could hop away.
"Now what?" she asked.
Jet went to open the gate, and Franny followed. "She'll just wind up in someone else's yard," Franny said.
"Yes, but it will be her choice."
Franny put the rabbit down on the sidewalk. For a moment it huddled there, staring at them.
"You're free,"
Franny said, waving her hands.
"Go on."
Maggie took off down the street, running so fast they never saw her again.
"Good riddance," Franny said.
"Good luck," Jet called after the creature. The cat always followed Jet about, but one day Wren disappeared, and when she returned home, another black cat, soon called Sparrow, followed. After that, there was another named Goose, and then yet another enormous long-haired cat, whom they called Crow, since he seemed far more interested in Lewis than he did in the other cats, even though the bird did little more than spend his days drowsing in a sunny spot on the porch. As it turned out, Wren was bringing home cats from an animal shelter on the other side of town, climbing in through a broken window, then leading them to Magnolia Street.
"You're becoming a cat lady," Franny observed.
"They chase away the rabbits," Jet responded.
"Yes," Franny said with a grin, but they never catch them. I'll bet old Harry could, if he wanted to, which he clearly does not. The dog was usually up on the porch with Louis, two old creatures who never were pets, and who now needed their food to be mixed with water, which was easier on the digestion. She wondered if the old dog dreamed of Vincent, as she did. She liked to imagine her brother in a village in France, strolling through the dusk with William, past fields and woods. Occasionally his song came on the radio. Jet always turned it off. Vincent's voice was too painful a reminder for her. But Franny would take the radio into the garden. She loved to listen to Vincent and was glad that people remembered him. Sometimes cards would arrive in the mail, postmarked from Paris. She kept these and tied blue ribbon around the stack she had collected. Only their address was written out, but the message was clear. I'm still here. The light on the porch was broken. Charlie Merrill had tried his best to fix it, but to no avail.
Circuits are shot, he said. It will cost a fortune to rewire. I recommend leaving it be.
Franny, nervous as ever about money, was quick to agree. So what if their doorway was dark? They certainly didn't expect visitors. It was fall, their favorite time of the year, and the evenings grew dark at an earlier hour. Jet had visited New York, as she did once a month, keeping her destination to herself, meeting Raphael at the Oak Bar. He was by far her oldest and best friend.
You look different, he had told her the last time she saw him. Happy.
Indeed, Jet had the feeling something was about to happen. And then one day when she was collecting the last of the rosemary that grew beside the door, thinking about Aunt Isabel's clients who often arrived at this hour, the porch light switched on. Jet stood up, holding the rosemary. It was wilted brown, but as she watched, it became green in her hands. Her gray eyes rimmed with tears. What she had lost had returned. When two girls passed by the fence, she knew what they were thinking, although she was too well-mannered to ever tell. She had the sight once more. It was Samhain, the last day in October, when doors between worlds are open and impossible things are accomplished. She began to work from Isabel's grimoire, starting with the easy recipes, chamomile for blessing, hyssop and holly to dispel a negative energy, and after a few weeks she progressed one of the most complex spells, the dove's heart love charm. She went to the butcher's for the heart, and afterward there was all sorts of chatter on Main Street. People peered out their windows as she walked home with a bloody paper bag. She was to prick the heart she had carefully prepared for a client who was to say, "My lover's heart will feel this pin, and his devotion I will win. There'll be no way for him to rest nor sleep until he comes to me to speak. Only when he loves me best will he find peace and with peace rest." That night the porch light was on. No trick-or-treaters ever came to the Owens house on Halloween. They were warned away by their parents and by tradition. But there were other people who were desperate to walk through the gate. The first woman came at dusk, knocking tentatively at the door. "It's probably someone trying to sell us something," Franny said. "Ignore it." All the same, Jet opened the door. There was the woman who had bought Mrs. Russell's house, the one Franny had run into years back when Isabel had fallen ill.
"What on earth are you doing here?" Franny wanted to know.
"Your light was on." The woman was unsure as to whether she should cross the threshold or back away. "I know what that means." Franny tossed her sister a dark look. Still, Jet motioned to their neighbor, who, after a glance around, proceeded to enter the kitchen.
"I suppose she wants something," Franny groused.
"Everyone wants something," Jet responded. "Even you." "It's about my husband," the woman said.
"Oh, God, not this again," Franny groaned.
"What about him?" Jet had already put the kettle up for tea. Their neighbor began to cry. Her husband was unfaithful, and it was tearing their family apart. It was then Franny realized that the girl she had met at the lake with the blue notebook was this woman's daughter. Franny now wondered if that was why the girl had asked if she was a witch, if she'd been in search of a spell to set things right in her family. Perhaps she'd been the one to suggest her mother come to them. "I may be able to help you," Jet said.
"Really?" Franny said to Jet. "Are we going to do this?"
"Go to the refrigerator," Jet told her sister. "It's on the second shelf." For once, Franny did as she was told. When she spied the dove's heart on a blue willowware plate, she laughed out loud. Here it was, their future and their fate. She had often found such unsavory items in the pantry or in the fridge, where their aunt had stored away the more questionable ingredients. It might also be a way for them to survive their dismal financial state. Franny turned to her sister, who was pouring cups of chamomile tea, good for the nerves.
"Remember," she told her sister, "there's a charge for these things."
"I'll pay anything," their neighbor told them. Franny brightened then. Perhaps this wasn't a completely worthless endeavor. Jet went to the cabinet. There was the jar of engagement rings they'd forgotten all about.
"Do you have one of these?"
The neighbor slipped off her diamond ring and handed it over.
"All right," Jet said. "Let's begin."
When Halen was wounded, he was posted in a makeshift hospital in the Delta, where the air was so hot it turned liquid. He had been there so long he no longer counted days. He no longer counted patients. One man after another was injured, some so dreadfully he would go outside and throw up into the dense greenery after he cared for them. When he himself was injured, he felt nothing at first. Only a rush of cold air as if the wind had cut through him, and then the heat of his blood. He was immediately airlifted to the hospital in Frankfurt where he had previously worked, and after surgery and intensive rehab, he was transferred to the American Hospital in Paris, on the Boulevard Victor Hugo. His father had insisted he be sent to the best private hospital in Europe, and the Navy had relented. It no longer mattered. Hay was done with his service. He had read all of Franny's letters 3 times over, but he didn't wish to upset her by informing her of the magnitude of his medical situation. Instead, he called the last person anyone would have expected him to contact, his father. Later, Franny would always say, "So if you had died, your father would have been the one to contact me?" And he would always answer, "I wasn't ready to die." Months had passed, and she hadn't heard from him. She was dizzy with worry, writing on a daily basis to the Navy. She called and got no information. She phoned the Walker residence and was told there was no one there who wished to speak to her. Well, that was nothing new. At last, Halen wrote, "This is one thing I didn't wish to share with you. The human body is so fragile, but more and more I think the soul has real possibilities." She flew to Paris immediately and took a room at a small hotel near the hospital. She didn't even take note of the name of the place. She left her suitcase and quickly showered and changed. She'd packed real clothes, not the raggedy stuff she usually wore. A Dior suit that had belonged to her mother. A pair of black heels. A purse her parents had given her one Christmas, purchased at Saks, which she had never before used. She didn't intend to spend much time at her hotel, perhaps not even to sleep. It was merely a place to leave her suitcase. At the hospital, the nurses were very kind. Too kind. She had been alarmed, and now her worry intensified. People spoke in hushed voices, and although Franny had excelled at the French language at school, everyone talked too fast for her to follow. They spoke to her in English, then, slowly, as if she were a child. She was told she must see the doctor before she could see Halen, and was brought to a well-appointed office. She was offered a coffee and then a drink, both of which she rejected.
"There's really no need for this," she said, pacing the room.
Then the doctor arrived, and she saw his expression, and she understood the news wasn't good.
she sat down and kept quiet.
The unit where Halen had been posted could not be called a hospital. It was a surgical tent. It was hidden by greenery, but on windy days it was possible to see their location, and there was a wind when it happened. During times of war, no one is immune, the doctor told her, not even those who are there to heal the wounded. When the medical tent was bombed, Dr. Walker had thrown himself across the patient he was working on. He did so without thinking, because it was in his nature, because he had always thought of others before himself. And so it had come to pass that he was the injured party.
"He's lost a leg," the doctor told her.
Franny made him repeat himself so she could be sure she hadn't imagined what he'd said. And there were burns, he informed her, now not as severe. She stood then and thanked the doctor for his time and asked if he could excuse her for a moment. She went into the hall, where she turned to the wall and sobbed. She felt a rushing in her ears, as if she had lost her hearing, as if the doctor had never said anything to her, as if none of it had happened. A nurse pulled her into a washroom so she could dash water on her face and compose herself. When she had, Franny reached into her purse for a comb and tidied her unruly hair, which the nurse pinned up so that it chicly framed her face. It was barely possible to see that she had broken down.
"Much better," the nurse said. "Let's not upset Dr. Walker. He doesn't like anyone to fuss. When you visit, you'll be calm."
Franny nodded and was taken upstairs. Hay had a private room overlooking the leafy street. His father had spared no expense and made sure there was always a private nurse on duty. Her name was Pauline, and she was quite beautiful. When Franny shook the nurse's hand, she was terribly jealous that this stranger had been here to watch over Hay and care for him so intimately, while she, herself, had been clueless, worrying about the library and the garden and all manner of frivolous things. Hay was usually in constant motion, always at work in some way, so it was a shock to see him trapped in bed. Franny was reminded of the time she went to Cambridge to visit him at Mass General, and Emily Flood came in, beautiful and young and windblown, there to ruin Franny's plan to win him back. She had had the same lump in her throat then, the same tumble into fear. She could not lose him now. It was unthinkable, for how could anything happen to Halen, who was so confident and sure of himself and of the world?
"There you are," he said, his face breaking into a grin when he saw her.
He reached for her, and she went to take his hand. She leaned to kiss him, then drew back and said, "Is this okay?" He pulled her to him and growled,
"This is the most okay thing that's happened in 18 months.
When the nurse found them in bed, Franny was made to wait in the hall while Halen was bathed. She was jealous yet again. But he was still Halen and still hers, no matter what had happened. All the same, he refused to talk about the bombing to her or anyone else. He had seen too much as a doctor to ask for pity or even compassion. He would be in France for some time, to be fitted with a prosthetic leg and learn how to deal with his medical reality and care for himself.
"Good thing I'm a doctor," he said.
He had no need to tell her what had happened. She had the sight. She saw everything in his eyes, the grief and horror he had seen. She saw that he was still worried over patients he had known, men he'd worked on but never saw again, whose fates he would never know. Franny had been so worried about Vincent serving in Vietnam, but had always imagined Halen would be safe, especially if she stayed away from him. He saw her regret and said,
"This is not the curse. This is fucking war, Franny. This is what happens to people."
She stayed late that first day, until at last the staff asked her to leave and return in the morning. She had not eaten and went to a cafe where she cried as she ate, but it was Paris and no one seemed to notice. She wished that Vincent were with her. He was the one who had always best understood her. She was not as tough as she seemed. She wished she could speak with her brother. As she had no idea where he was, she went to the place where she had last had a glimpse of him and William. She took a taxi to the cemetery, but found it was closed for the evening.
"You can climb over the far wall," the taxi driver told her.
Everyone does. There's a stepladder to help you. Run if you see the guard.
And so she entered the cemetery after hours. Inside, it wasn't as dark as she expected. There was a moon and lamplight. She took note of some shadowy figures. Not grave robbers, but fans there to pay homage at Jim Morrison's grave. They had left flowers and candles. She asked the group if they knew the way to Vincent Owens's grave. One of the girls, an American who wore a torn T-shirt, said,
"Who?"
And the young man with her said,
"You know the guy. I walk at night."
He then turned to Franny with a map he allowed her to use. After she found Vincent's grave listed, she made her way to it, past Marcel Proust's gravesite, past the site of Adolphe Thiers, the prime minister under King Louis-Philippe, whose 19th-century ghost was rumored to tug on visitors' clothing if they came close, past the lipstick-kiss-covered grave of Oscar Wilde. There, at last, was Vincent's headstone. Agnès Durant had ordered it, since Franny and Jet had been too distressed to do so at the time. It was very stark and beautiful. A white stone with his name and the dates of his birth and death. Franny leaned down and kissed the stone. She stayed until it was pitch dark. Perhaps she thought if she waited long enough he would manage to find her. But the place was deserted, and at last she went back to where the taxi was waiting. Vincent had always known his life would end young, but she was thankful that somewhere a new one had begun. She asked to return to the hospital. She would sleep in a chair in the lounge until visiting hours began. She had become jealous of Paris. Halen had fallen in love with the hospital. Every day that he was stronger, he seemed more at home. He had begun to meet with the doctors, not just about his own case, but also to discuss the histories of other patients. He'd been an excellent surgeon and would be again. Rather than stand during an operation, he could sit in a chair that rose up so there would not be pressure on his good leg. On days when Hay was busy, Franny walked through the city. She liked to go to the café in the Tuileries, a place Madame Durant had told her Vincent had frequented, and to the Ile de la Cité, where she sat on a wall near the cathedral, so she might watch the river, and to the garden of the Rodin Museum, where the budding roses were impossibly large. One day she found herself in the Place Vendôme. She had been following a crow, aimless, with no particular destination in mind, until the bird had led her here. She went into the Ritz and asked if she might use the telephone. Allowed to do so, she called Madame Durant, who lived around the corner on the Boulevard de la Madeleine. She was invited to tea. Just a short visit, that was all that could be managed, for Madame was preoccupied with plans to leave the city for her country house. The housekeeper was waiting at the door, poised to show her in. It was a very beautiful, tall house, covered with vines. The shutters were painted black, but the light was so glorious, who would ever want to try to shut it out?
"Well, here you are," Madame Durant said, kissing Franny lightly. "What a surprise."
But the truth was, she knew Franny would arrive someday. It was difficult to keep the truth from someone with the sight. Every once in a while, Franny thought she could see Vincent in a field of yellow flowers. Now she and Madame Durant sat by the window at a marble table. The light fell through the room in bright bands, illuminating some things and leaving other items in the dark. The furniture was upholstered in apricot silk, and the walls were fabric, gold brocade. The woodwork was all painted a pale blue that might have been white, but wasn't. Franny thought her mother would have loved the room.
"We were roommates during her time here. We had this small apartment that we adored. But Susanna thought everything was beautiful," Agnes said, "when she was in love."
"Yes, the man she ruined."
"She didn't ruin him, dear. He drowned. They were on a sailboat, and she, being one of us, couldn't save him because she could not dive underwater. She tried. She was hospitalized after because of the cold, but it did no good."
Franny was stunned by the idea that she and her mother were so alike. She remembered waking from a deep sleep as a child to find her mother sitting in a chair by her bed, watching over her.
"She was crushed, but she went on with her life in New York. When she gave birth to you, she wrote me a long letter about how perfect you were.